Hello, everyone. Welcome to One Shared Brain Cell. It is me, Fiona from the Spare Room, Rich off of the Tarantula Family.
Hello.
And Leah off of Glorified Pet Rocks.
Hi there.
So our guest is Jeremy off of Jeremy's Wild World.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Thank you for joining us.
We're so excited that you're here. What's new in your world?
Just in life in general. I've just started my second year in university, doing my apprenticeship course, working in operating theatres. But hobby-wise, just been getting along with all the projects going on here. You know, stuff is coming in and out all the time. Projects, just general husbandry.
And how is uni going and the placement, theatre placement going?
Yeah, it's going good. First year finished with no issues at all. Second year now, two more years to go. So hopefully it leads to me graduating at the end of it, becoming a full-time practitioner. Yeah.
Amazing,
yeah.
Wow. All right, then. So tell us a bit about more about yourself, like how you got into keeping inverts and other animals and like what you love about keeping animals.
Yeah, so as we just briefly discussed, career-wise, at the moment, I'm going down the path of working in the operating theatre department as an apprentice at the moment. That's my study at the moment. It wasn't initially what I planned to do, so with including this hobby, prior to COVID, I was in college studying animal management. So had my diploma, original diploma, was studying to do my external extended diploma and then go to university to study zoology, specialising in entomology. But, you know, COVID stuff happens, plan didn't go as planned. I didn't finish my senior diploma. So that's why I'm doing the operating course now. But just in regards to the hobby, like I mentioned prior to COVID, I was studying animal management and I was going down the avenue for aquatics. Like I was really into aquatics before, breeding various species, and I was hoping to go into possibly marine biology. But my tutor, who I was quite close with at the time, still talked to right at the like present day. He mentioned about the invert shows and I had no idea about the shows at all. So we were going to go to the Bedford show, me, my tutor and a friend of mine. That didn't happen, so he said to go to the Brighton one, which I did, and I was thinking, oh, invert show, maybe there'll just be a few things on display, get to chat to a few people about it. So I thought I'd just go by myself, go have a look, and my god, was I completely wrong in regards to that. You know, going into the show and seeing the thousands of people there, the variety of invertebrates there, my brain just started ticking. And like when I really do like something, I put like a lot of work into, you know, getting the knowledge base and stuff. So I started watching videos and reading up on forums and stuff like that on how to care for these animals. Because, you know, you only really see the invertebrates for a general person, like in documentaries and stuff like that. But seeing them in person and being able to keep them as pets was something I never thought I would ever be doing, but now here I am today.
Well, they are very inspirational, aren't they, the shows, the big shows. You can't help but get some, there's like a sort of group excitement and you get swept along by it, don't you? And you kind of like filter out the bits that you want to get really fascinated by. And
I didn't filter. I honestly couldn't filter anything. I was just there, just soaking it all in. I couldn't believe it. There were some animals. I remember vividly 2019. It was Venomous Visions. They had the coconut crabs on the table. I was like, I saw these on documentaries as a kid, and now I see one in front of me. That someone can own one. I'm like, this is so cool.
Yeah.
I went to the invitation. I'm not buying anything. I came home with a load of invertebrates, and at the time I was just starting to do YouTube just to document like my fish stuff. Had the snails but didn't have invertebrates properly. But yeah, once I started like hyper focusing on research into invertebrates, I've been jumping between different groups of animals. So I was really into mantids, phasmids. I kept a lot of those as well, isopods, and now I've got my niche that I'm at now, but I'm sure we can talk about that later on. But yeah, just in general, the invertebrates truly have changed the way I am, and you know, just hopefully being able to do it as a career at some point would be really cool. But regardless of where I go in life, the animals will always still be here with me.
I've followed you for quite a while, and I've sort of seen you go from this amazing keeper, still amazing keeper, but like now you're starting to breed a lot, and we'll come on to that in a bit, but like you're selling at shows now, right?
Yeah.
So cool. So cool. Okay.
Yeah, I never thought I was going to sell at shows, but Lee was pushing on to me because of the amount of animals I had. It's like, would you be interested in having a table? And I thought, maybe I would like to give it a go. So that was my first trading show. It was Bedford 2022. Did fantastic. I've done a few shows since then. You know, it helps my hobby. You know, people get to enjoy the animals that I enjoy. I get to have more funds to, you know, feed the animals, get new projects and stuff like that. But yeah, we can discuss that more in detail later on today, I assume.
Yeah.
Do you find that people, do you find you get asked a lot of questions and advice? If so, do you find that the people are asking the right questions and that give you hope that people genuinely want to care for what they're buying?
Yeah. I've definitely, being a trader, was because I helped like other traders before, just, you know, giving a hand with Tony from Venomous Visions, and I've helped other stands as well. But being a trader myself and having people ask a question about the animals, you can tell that people do, how do I phrase it? They do show a really good interest in them. And, you know, I could talk for ages. And when I'm trading, I go with my dad. And my dad just looks at me like, Jeremy, just you know, give him a little bit of advice. Don't stop rambling. I'm like, I'm so passionate about these animals, you know, I can just go on and on. Yeah. And then, you know, they're asking me the right questions. I'm giving them the right husbandry advice for them. And, you know, I'm getting updates from my breeding projects, people sending me pictures, look how big it is now. And or if they're buying isopods, look how well they're doing. It's very satisfying, to say the least.
That's really, that's encouraging, isn't it? Because you want to know that when someone's buying an animal off you, that it's going to be cared for. And it sounds very hopeful that they all are, which is great. Yeah,
because, you know, at the end of the day, this is a hobby for me. And like I always say to people, regardless of whether I'm trading or not, or like, I don't care about the money. It's kind of a weird thing. I do it for mainly to, you know, keep none of the money I make at the shows goes to me personally. It all goes back into the animal. Whether it's for food, whether it's for new projects, like I mentioned. But, you know, there are many times where like a younger fan from me will come up to me and be like, oh, I'm really interested in the animals, but my mum's not too keen on me getting some. But then I'll have a chat with the mum and slightly convince her. There's a couple of times, I gave probably about 80 quid's worth of animals for the kid for like a tenner. Because for me, it's a young generation. I'm going to keep the hobby going, keep their interest up. And, you know, if they're happy, I'm happy.
Excellent. That's really encouraging.
That's amazing. What are or are your favorite inverts to keep?
When people ask me, that's such a tough question, because I don't specialize in anything really. Like, you probably tell from just behind me on the video side, there's so many different species I've kept, and I bounce between many different niches within the hobby trying to find what works for me. And I've really taken a passion in the true spiders. Basically non-tarantulas and other curtain webs, megalomorphs essentially, so true spiders have been like a big thing for me. I started off, you know, just taking a general interest on the colors and stuff like that. So I started off with, you know, Hedgepeda David Bowie, Hedgepeda Bowie, David Bowie Huntsman, Lichen Huntsmans, you know, really, really interested in those. And I managed to get my first breeding projects with the Huntsman as well. I've bred multiple species, which people will say that they bred them, but realistically it's a wild caught female that's dropped a sack and the babies have hatched. And I've done that too. I've raised the slings and you know, getting them out to people as well. But for me, it's getting these captive bred specimens is so satisfying to watch. You know, you're the reason why that the babies are around in the first place, you know. I've done, like I said, various huntsman species, wandering spiders, wolf spiders, velvet spiders. The list goes on and on. And I've done and probably documented a few species that have not been captured before. One I'm really was excited about was the Theltocoppus species called Black, which is on my new logo now. If you guys check out social media and stuff, she's in the corner. There have been papers done on them before, but there's not been any documented papers on pairing. And stupid hours waiting for my pair to pair, got the photos. Unfortunately, didn't come to fruition. I didn't get a sack, but just being able to document the male pairing with the female, not been seen before, and it's been very impressive. And, you know, stuff like that. But yeah, true spiders is great. What especially I like about them is just the variety of looks. from the body structures of the different spiders to the hunting behaviors. That's what I like the most. You know, you have your wolf spiders that are visual hunters and can chase down prey from the enclosure. You have your net casting spiders, which will hang from, say, a branch with a net, waiting with their binocular eyes for prey to walk underneath them, and they'll net them up, wrap them up and eat them like that. Orb weavers, you know, camouflage reliant hunters, like your huntsman spiders and stuff. Yeah, I could just go on and on, but true spiders is something that I feel people are starting to enjoy a lot more, and I'm more than happy to help people, whether it's for them getting into species from other places or if they want to get stuff from me as well.
Because we were saying earlier on, weren't we, that we'd noticed that Jeremy was far more into true spiders than your tarantula, and it's, and I was going to ask why that was, but it, you just explained it brilliantly. So it makes perfect sense.
But that's pretty amazing that about the Belctacophis, like you were able to witness that. I think that's the start of any decent research, is just being able to witness it, basically.
Yeah, and it's, well, when it comes to like the pairings and stuff, I'm always trying to at least take a photo of the pairing happening. You'll see on my Instagram page there, I don't post a lot, general posts. I'll normally just post on my story. But I, like, you know, I could, as you know, I do YouTube and stuff. I could sit there with the camera recorded, but for me, I'm focusing on making sure that male doesn't get eaten. Trying to make sure I get the right photo up close, you know, because a quick snap and then I can concentrate back on making sure that both spiders are okay at the end of the pairing, because you never know what can happen. Not every pairing plan, you know, whether the female's just not receptive, kills the male. There are times where even the males have been documented to attack females as well if they're not, if they're in a defensive mode rather than a mating mode. So I just sit there for ridiculous amounts of time, hunched over with my camera, just sitting there waiting to quickly snap a pic and carry on. And, you know, being able to document the whole process from the pairing to the sac to the babies emerging. It's, I've done that a few times now, and it's absolutely awesome.
Amazing. Yeah.
It's interesting what you were saying earlier, because you were saying about you had that pairing of a rare, the rarer breeding process. It wasn't fruitful in the end. It's the actual documentation of the process rather than relying solely on it being a success, whether it, whether it's an egg sac or not. It's new and interesting that pushes the interesting in the hobby forward, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's with me, it's I could just post all the positives, because yes, I do have quite a lot of successes, but I feel like for me at a learning curve, and for people that are interested in the animals I'm interested in too, is the realism of the side of doing these pairings, even just keeping in general, whether I'm successful with a species or not. You know, I always try to do things that is a challenge, and whether it works or not, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's just experimenting and trying my best. Now, I do post stuff that doesn't work out. You know, I've had many pairings. An example, the giant Australian huntsmans, the Holconia insignis, got the pairing done, got the sac. I had a torch shining through the sac, and you see the nymphs crawling inside, and at that point, I had learned to take sacks away and raise them separately. But yeah, I thought, you know what, let's leave it with the mum this time. And I went away for a trip with my family and came back to find that the female had eaten the sack. And there was one little nymph just crawling on the floor, which unfortunately didn't do too well after that. And I could have just hid it. You know, I posted the pictures of me pairing them, but I did post online saying that the sack was eaten. And, you know, it's just, it's heartbreaking for sure, getting to that close stage of having a successful pairing. But at the end of the day, for me, I like to educate people. And
I think it's so important to be honest about breeding projects and things like that. Like, I remember when I first started breeding tarantulas, and I started off with like some really easy species just to like ease me in, sort of thing. So the first one I did was Acanthus scuria geniculata, and I don't know what happened, but the sack just failed and I was heartbroken. But like,
it is important to document that it doesn't always go exactly to plan.
I think I actually cried on Instagram. Oh, I was
bless you.
She was going to be a mother.
Because if you have somebody that's been in the hobby for a while but never bred before, but they have their favourite species and they want to breed it, if they only ever see successful pairings and successful breedings, if theirs don't always work, they're going to assume they're doing something wrong, when it's good to document how it really happens rather than just showing every success story and then leading people to believe that it happens perfectly every time.
Be true. So, obviously, I've seen your picture on Instagram. You've got two, amazingly, a one-to-one pair as hatched. And I assume you can't tell the gender from the cocoon, right?
Oh, you can.
You can? Babies, oh, yeah. Amazing. Yeah. So you picked a one-to-one pair on purpose then, I assume?
Yeah, so I had attended the Amateur Entomological Society show, which is held at the Kempton Race Park. It's an entomological show, judged by the name. A lot of pin stuff, but there's livestock sellers as well. And there's this one company, I believe they're called like the Butterfly Farm. They specialize, obviously, in Lepidopterans, which is butterflies and moths. Yeah. And they always bring a massive variety of cocoons, including my Atticus Atlas. And back in 2022, I bought a pair from them. Unfortunately, at that time, my male had emerged way before the female, so no pairing was done then. But I was lucky enough this time to have both a male and a female emerge at a similar time, so that gives me a good chance to hopefully get them breeding. And I also have a second pair of cocoons which are very close to hatching as well.
Amazing. Yeah. Oh, so that was what I was going to ask. Is there a breeding plan for your moths?
Yes, definitely. It's not always easy breeding them, you know. The main factor is the emergence. So ideally you want female to emerge before male with the Atticus Atlas, but with them being at the same time, they should have a relatively similar time frame. They don't last long as adults. At most, they'll last maybe a couple weeks. It's normally less as adults, since they don't eat. Their sole purpose is to breed. They don't even have any mouth parts with this particular
species.
Yeah, so Lepidopterans in general, butterflies and moths, whether they eat or not, you could argue that they're quite a good agricultural control, where, you know, if there was nothing that was eating the leaves, that the plants would just keep growing and growing and growing. Yeah, the caterpillars eat a lot. In the hobby, they eat mainly privet. I know there's other food plants, but I don't know not off the top of my head, but they mainly eat privet. And yeah, the caterpillars just eat and eat and eat. And ideally, they'll build up enough fat stores so they can last long as an adult, since they'll just rely on the fat reserve that they have left over from their caterpillar stage.
They are breathtaking.
Now, I assume that not all butterflies don't eat them.
No, so yeah, some moths do feed. Notable species are the hawk and hummingbird moths. They have a proboscis similar to a butterfly, and they'll pollinate as well. But yeah, Atticus Atlas don't have any mouth parts at all.
When I first started keeping inverts, I was playing Animal Crossing a lot, and you can capture Atlas moths on there. And I was like, yes, caught an Atlas moth. I saw them at Warwick, and I was like, they do not even look real. It's insane.
They actually have, I believe the term is called Batesian or Batesian mimicry, on the tips of their wings, which mimic a snake's head. And it's theorized to put off predators such as birds and other lizards that might be tempted to have a bite. They'll flap their wings to make it look like a moving head of a snake.
Amazing.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I'm looking at it now. I get, oh my God, yeah.
We'll have to link some pictures to sort of to show what we've been talking about, because it's fascinating.
Yeah. What's been your favourite breeding project and why?
Ooh, good question. Do you mind if I give a couple answers?
Yeah.
Yeah, so with regards to the true spies, I think the most satisfying breeding project for me was Hedgepoda lanula. They have a couple of common names, which is the, I think they call them the lightning or purple huntsman spiders.
They are beautiful.
They are gorgeous spiders. And I was very fortunate enough, a lovely lady reached out to me saying that she had an adult female. She was debating on whether to sell her on, and I said I would grab her from her with the intention of potentially breeding her in the future. Now, at the time, I wasn't very hopeful, as Lanula is not very common in the hobby. But it was fate for me to have the spider, so I managed to find a mature male from a guy. He sent him over to me, and I literally I had a work night, and I stayed up till about 1:30 in the morning waiting for this male to do his thing, because I popped him in the enclosure and waited for him at the dark. At the time I was in my bedroom, the room was pitch black, and I just let him wander around and do the pairing. That's all documented on my Instagram page. I have the pairing on there. And what I ended up doing was gifting the lady a baby of that spider, as well as when she did eventually pass away, I got her taxidermied in a dome so she could have the female as well. That was really nice because I know she had quite an attachment to the spider. She grew up from a baby, so give her a baby and her back as well.
That's lovely. I remember the first time I saw one, it was Hannah's that had one, and I was so jealous. Because we at that point, we didn't have them in the UK. Because they're quite a recent thing, aren't they?
Yeah, there was quite a few imports of wild-caught specimens in. So it's nice to see that they're starting to be able to get into the hobby more. Obviously, with the goal of me, I'd probably acquire some pairs again in the future to try and get some more babies out there. I know there's loads of them spread out throughout the UK at the moment, some of my babies.
So what's the next one that you loved?
It would have to be my top wolf spider that I currently have. That is the Hogna Madeiriana, also known as the Porto Santo or Madeira wolf spider. Gorgeous species of Lycosidae or wolf spider, smaller one. Finding pairs is not easy because you can't get wild caught because they're protected from where they are now. So whatever's in the hobby is in the hobby. So I got a pair, luckily enough, got them bred. Raised up a second generation, which have now been paired, and now I've got Gen 3 here now. Gen 3? No, Gen 2, sorry. I have second generation babies from my previous pairing. No, they're not interbred. I made sure to get two different males, two different females, raised them all up, got those two paired, and then, yeah, now I've got a second generation of baby wolf spiders. So that's satisfying. From your own breeding, two adults, and getting those adults to have more babies. F2s, fantastic.
So do you have any more exciting breeding projects?
Well, I've got one that's currently on the go, which is not a true spider, but a species of beetle. So I've been very interested in breeding the Asbolus varicosus, which are known in the hobby as the blue death fading beetles.
I saw this on your story.
Aren't they notoriously difficult to breed?
They say it's difficult, but I've been slowly building up, making sure I have everything ready. So even before I had the beetles, because I was waiting for the import, I bought myself an incubator. I did so much reading, and now I've been watching a few videos in regards to breeding them. And I was really curious, so I was digging around in the enclosure the other day, found myself my very first larva. So that's super exciting. I've got one now. The larvae are the easier part of this project. The main part is getting the pupa to emerge into an adult beetle. So that's the whole purpose of the incubator, keeping it super hot, super humid, to make sure that these pupa reach to adulthood. So I'm just super excited about that. Just last night, of recording this podcast, I saw a female digging around laying eggs. So hopefully in the next couple months, I'll have loads of larvae to try and get to pupation.
Oh, amazing.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
Honestly, you had one, didn't you?
I did, yeah. I loved
blueberry.
It.
Blueberry. Yeah. Is it called?
Yeah, blueberry, yeah. I think my biggest mistake was only keeping one.
They can actually live communally with the Hadrurus arizonensis, the desert hairy scorpions as well. They've been documented in wild sharing burrows. The exoskeleton is so hard on them. They're actually in a group of beetles known as ironclad beetles, so their exoskeleton is super tough. The scorpions just don't bother, and they don't bother the scorpions, so they share the burrow. And kind of like in a mutual beneficial way, scorpion gives protection to the beetles. Beetles clean up any rumors, I guess, from the scorpions too.
So
there's always something else to learn, isn't there?
So, completely different question. Is there a spider that intimidates you that you've kept, or a spider that you wouldn't keep?
Right. I'm going to give, again, a couple answers. I know I keep giving you a couple, should be one, but I like talking, so I'm going to give you a couple answers.
We like
you
talking.
Thank you. So there are a couple things I've kept before. A prime example are the giant pill millipedes, and the fire snails, which the scientific name is escaping me, but so I've had the fire snails and them. So I got them both. Fully well knowing that about the dietary requirements, I tried a few things that people have suggested, and unfortunately both times they didn't last too long in my care, which is theorized because of certain slime molds, algae, mushrooms that they eat in the wild that benefit their gut bacteria, which if they don't get in the hobby, is theorized that why they can't survive is even if they're eating, their gut bacteria isn't breaking down and they're able to absorb the nutrients from the food, they just eventually just starve. So yeah, I've kept both of those. So those kind of animals that have, you know, weird diets, other animals that are in the hobby as well, well, that do come in. I don't know about UK, but I don't know if you guys are aware of the trilobite beetles. Yeah, those kind of things, like they don't do well because they just don't eat. It's just, yeah, any animal that has a weird dietary requirement, I don't think personally I would keep again, just because I don't think it's fair. There's a few animals out there which I feel, well, invertebrates that, in the hobby wise, I don't think do well at all. Yeah, like I said, the fire snails, I wouldn't keep again. Giant pill millipedes, I personally wouldn't keep again either. Trying to think of some trilobite beetles, even if they did come to the UK, which I don't think they will, because I think it's well known that they just don't do well. I think, yeah, just invertebrates that just don't eat well in captivity, I personally wouldn't keep again.
Are there any species you can think of that that when they first came to the hobby didn't thrive very well, but knowledge has grown, so now they're being kept successfully?
That is actually a very, very good question. Oh, I would actually have to say, from just seeing me myself in the hobby just in the past few years, the care has vastly improved. Camel spiders, the family Solifugiae, camel spiders are notoriously known for not doing well in captivity. Mm. And I think from the experience from myself and other keepers, we've now determined that, one, they are a primarily dormant species. So that means that they're typically underground, not moving. They just sit in a burrow until a season comes along where they're going looking for food, looking for mates. Some species are like that. We were keeping them definitely way too cold. You know, the saying for the hobby is, if you're fine, they're fine. But camel spiders are typically coming from quite hot areas. Certainly desert, but definitely arid. So heat was an element that was missing in their care. And also people assuming that they're dead. So camel spiders, when they go into a molting position, they kind of look like they're dead. They put their arms like basically behind their head and they curl to the side. And I theorize that a lot of people have just not intentionally thrown them away, but they look dead when they're molting. And they can stay like that for weeks. I had a camel spider that matured out male, but he was in a molting pre-molt for 2 months and then was in a molting position for an additional 2 months before finally deciding to pop out of a molt. Wow. So you can see hobbyists would assume that they're dead. So now that knowledge is being passed around, even working on some tables whilst helping a guy at the Glasgow show, people asking about the camel spiders. And I actually had one guy reach out to me saying that his one has now successfully molted, and thank you for the tips in regards to care. So, you know, just being for myself, learning that, I've been able to help at least one keeper successfully get a camel spider to molt. So, yeah, I feel like the camel spiders are definitely, hopefully, going to be able to thrive more in captivity with heat, making sure you don't throw them out when you think they're dead, and essentially just leaving them alone. If you don't see them for a while, don't dig them up, just leave them be.
I wanted to keep a camel spider, but I knew there was no way I could keep it as hot. Because you are so right. Like, if you're warm, they're warm. That's not a thing when the animal's natural, like, temperature is, like, 30 plus.
Yeah. If they're coming from the Middle East, then you're looking at an entirely different...
Yeah.
North Africa, Middle East, an entirely different...
Exactly. Yeah.
How are your questions coming along?
They are coming along. I actually only have one more question left.
I think you've got to say it out loud.
Oh, you didn't say you wanted to know what it was. You just asked me how they were coming along. Right, so the last question, Jeremy, is what is your favourite thing about the community?
The hobby has definitely built up my confidence, just socially. People coming up to me at shows now, tapping me on the shoulder and be like, oh, hello, I'm a big fan. And I'm like, oh, my God, I'm just a person. But hello, thank you for the support. And, you know, just meeting good friends like yourselves and people in general. You know, the nights out before shows, I'm sure you've seen my drunken escapades on Facebook.
Yeah.
Has to be done.
It looks fun.
Oh, it's great. You guys need to get to a night out before a show. It's fantastic.
I'm scared of that hangover.
Oh, yeah. The hangovers the next day are not great, but worth it. But yeah, you know, the community is just great. You know, we live in a world where we are not the normal, but it's nice to be with people that consider our hobby normality and being able to discuss our hobby and just, you know, talk to like-minded people, whether I'm trading or attending the shows, is just absolutely fantastic. Or even social media, people DM me asking me questions, talking today on the podcast. It's overall just, I love the community and how we all genuinely get along. You do have some of the bad bunch come along every now and then, but, you know, generally they're pushed aside and ignored, and the community aspect is just absolutely fantastic.
Mm. When you're talking about your confidence growing and you were more... you felt more capable to be involved, that's been a good return for the community, because you've got so much knowledge and you're so happy to share it, that without the confidence that the community had given you, the community wouldn't have that knowledge. So
it's full circle.
I love the community.
Yeah, yes, it's amazing. And also what you're saying about when every now and again when a bad bugger comes along, I think there's no support from the community for the bad keepers. They just won't have a place there because the community won't want them to settle somewhere spreading their terrible posts and bad keeping. It's like it's like a self.
And like we get wheedled out like immediately.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that's quite often the fly by night because they're in it because it's a thing, the hobby du jour. So they don't stay in it for very long because there's no rewards. It's brilliant.
So Jeremy, is there anything that we haven't spoken about, or anything we haven't asked that you'd like to tell us about, or anything that you're doing that you want to share?
Something that I would like to share, just for anyone that's getting into the hobby, it's in regards to just breeding in general, or just keeping animals that you want to keep. If you guys are interested in that kind of aspects of the hobby, don't go into it thinking that it's a cash grab. I do make a good amount at shows through breeding, but the amount of hours that I put into this, and I'm doing it because I enjoy it. Main thing for breeding, guys, don't use it as an excuse for, oh, loads of money is going to come in if I breed this, I'm going to have thousands of pounds. No, do it because you enjoy it, because then you'll enjoy it more. You're not stressing out about losses within the breedings, because there will be losses. Not like t-shirts. You know, when you have t-shirts, you buy 100, they sit there, you can sell them whenever. You have an egg sack, you could have 100, then you could have 10, you could have the whole sack crash, you never know. So go into this project, projects in general. I always encourage people to try and captive breed, because that's what's going to sustain a hobby. There are always worries where countries could just decide, we're not exporting animals anymore. A prime example, Chile. Chile used to have, your classic hobby species, Gramosola rosea, which is now Porteri, and now rosea too, no color form. I don't know. But you used to be able to get them for 10, 20 quid. And now you won't see slings cheaper than £40, and adult females going for about 150 to 180. And that's because they cut off export. And people weren't breeding them, so they vanished for a while, and people put the work in. Now there are populations of them, but if we don't continue captive breeding, we could lose species forever in the hobby. I always do encourage to go out, do your research, find sources to people that would grab the slings off you in bulk if you are just a casual hobbyist. Make those connections. That's what the hobby's about. Chat to people, get a gauge of interest. And just enjoy the process. It's absolutely insane watching a spider communicate, pair, get the sack, get the babies. It's a fantastic project. So even in general, even with isopods, get like isopods set on your tub, having all those babies there, and use the money to fund your hobby. Because this hobby can get very expensive. And again, with just wanting to keep animals in general, as long as you guys do the research that is required for the animal, and you have a good multiple sources of information, and you get a general consensus of, okay, this is how I'm going to care for the animal, that's how I would recommend you guys get into this hobby. You can watch videos, of course, but definitely do get, like I said, multiple sources of information. That's how I learned. That's how personally I've was able to, you know, recite scientific names now. I don't use common names. I'm not saying common names is a bad thing. It's just for me.
I am.
Fair enough. You know, I couldn't before. No, just get them stuck in my head. I was giving my invertebrates names, you know, pet names, but I said, you know, let's get these scientific names ingrained, and now I only use scientific. So, you know, that kind of thing. But yeah, just research, guys. That's the main thing about this hobby, learning, and patience too. A lot of patience in this hobby too.
That's amazing. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's such a privilege to have a brilliant guest on that's just...
thank you.
Fills our ears with knowledge. Brilliant. Thank you.
All right. Yeah. Have a lovely, lovely evening. We'll catch you soon.
Sleep well. I appreciate you guys. Take care.
Yes.
Bye-bye.
Well, thank you very much for listening, everyone. On behalf of myself, Fiona and Leah, is it Leah? I think it's Leah, yeah. On behalf of the three of us, say a big thank you to everyone that's listened. A big thank you to Jeremy. And we promise to be much better at recording audio next time. So thank you all for listening, and we will catch you soon. Bye-bye.